This is PRN.FM, giving you a daily progressive take on the world.
Thank you so much for joining us today. This is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse. And as always, I'm wishing you the best. And today we're going to have a guest a little bit later on in the show. Her name is Heather Hasenflaz, PhD. And we're going to talk about some of the newest research on healing nutraceuticals, including what might be one of your favorites, which is cocoa or chocolate, a lot of the latest research that has been going on with that. So we'll bring you up to date a little bit later in the show with Dr. Heather. But right now, I'd like to give you some information about some political actions you may want to take, because if you're keeping up with what's going on in terms of genetically modified foods and Monsanto, you may be aware that Monsanto has launched a series of sneak attacks which would negatively influence the availability of organic food and non-GMO farmers as well as consumers, because there's a U.S. House of Representatives 2013 Agriculture Appropriations Bill, and the rider that Monsanto is attempting to attach to that bill would allow new genetically engineered crops to be planted even when the courts rule that the U.S. Department of Agriculture has said that they are illegal. So even though they are claimed to be illegal by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, they could still be planted. Now, as these crops get into the ground, what happens is all kinds of things. One of the things is they are causing, even as we speak, the development of resistant strains of both microorganisms and other agricultural pests, which are destroying crops. So the promise that Monsanto carries of having higher yields actually is causing the exact opposite, which is lower yields, and instead of having stronger plants, we are seeing the development of weaker plants. And instead of having weaker microorganisms and weaker bugs that attack plants, we're having stronger ones. So that's what's actually going on. And in addition, we're very happy that right now in California, they have managed to have on the voting legislation for this coming November, legislation that would allow people to actually vote on mandating labeling of GMOs. Now, if you've seen any of this on TV, and I'm happy to say it's actually is on TV, one of the things that's going on with that is that of course, there's a big pushback by agribusiness. And what agribusiness is saying is that that would confuse people too much. So would that be true about you, listeners? Would you be confused if your products were labeled GMO? In other words, would that make it very confusing for you to make a choice about whether you wanted to purchase GMO or not? They felt that it would be very confusing for you if you were to know that your produce or your food is full of GMO. So that's their only argument. They're not saying that it's unsafe to know. Now, one of their attacks is to produce a group of commercials that are pointing out that it will be more expensive. The food will be more expensive if it has to be labeled. Well, actually, that might be true. because they may purposefully increase the price of food to scare people away from GMO labeling. But have you ever seen the little tag on your fruits and vegetables? There's a little tag on there right now, and it always starts with a number. If it starts with the number 9, that indicates that the produce is organic. At least let's hope so, because you know these little stickers? I've seen them in the grocery store where they're just, you know, little stickers that you might stick on an envelope. I don't know who exactly is regulating where these stickers actually wind up. The fruit and vegetables don't come in with the sticker. They're put on this on in the grocery store, and I don't know who's watching, you know. I mean, supposedly they're supposed to put the sticker that has the number 9 on the things that are organic. And then things that have a 3 or 4 indicate various things, such as country of origin. As you know, a great deal of our produce, especially non-organic produce, is grown in other countries. And in those countries, they allow the spraying of many pesticides and herbicides that are so incredibly detrimental that they're actually outlawed in the United States. A very old example of this, but one that you may have heard of, is DDT. DDT was linked to cancer and birth defects and was actually outlawed in terms of its use in the United States. Another one is Alar. Alar was used on apples for 24 years here on the fields in the United States until it was linked so profoundly to the increased development of juvenile leukemia, probably from over-ingesting apple juice, as a matter of fact, because actually giving babies and children straight apple juice is a very bad idea to begin with because of the high sugar content. But be that as it may, the inorganic apple juice is laced with pesticides and herbicides, and Alar was used for 24 years all over this country until it was determined that it was so toxic and so clearly linked to the increase in childhood leukemia that it would be outlawed. So it was outlawed here in the country. So we'll talk about these two, but this is only two of many, many that have been outlawed in the United States. What happens to these pesticides and herbicides when they're outlawed in the United States? Do they go out of existence? Do they disappear from the face of the earth? Well, they certainly should, because why humans are so involved in producing toxic chemicals that actually kills them and their children, I'm not clear on that. If you have an answer to it, I'd be interested in knowing what your thoughts are about why we as a species do this. But nonetheless, guess what happens when these things are found to be extremely dangerous and they are outlawed in the United States? They are simply continued to be produced and just blithely shipped to third world nations, where produce continues to be grown with them. And of course, in those places, there is no regulation. So they can be widely and extensively used. So apples in other countries can be sprayed with Alar to their heart's content. And as a matter of fact, DDT is still fully available and fully used right here in all other countries. And then guess what happens when those fruits are grown? They are shipped right back to the United States. So if you're buying any produce that has a sticker on it that has either a 3 or a 4, guess what? You are consuming DDT, Alar, and any number of other toxic chemicals that are widely sprayed on conventional produce in other countries. In addition, you know, the workers there don't have any kinds of protections. And here, to tell you the truth, there are many workers, especially undocumented workers, that don't have any protections either. And it's interesting when we hear the entire big business debate in this country saying one of the problems is the over concerns of EPA, that's the Environmental Protection Agencies, and they would like to roll back many of those protections. So if they roll back those protections, then perhaps then business would profit, because then they could use such things as DDT and Alar once again in this country. And don't forget, those are just two of thousands of chemicals that are dumped on our food supplies every single day and are increasingly linked to the high level of degenerative illness that we can see in this country. So what can you do about it? Well, one thing you can do about it is choose non-GMO organic food, and also you're supporting the farmers, because should these laws go into effect that I was mentioning earlier, then a farmer's choice to grow non-engineered crops could also be taken away, and that's happening every day. If you want to see a wonderful movie that shows what goes on in terms of Monsanto suing farmers, like if you were a farmer and you chose to grow non-GMO food, but next door your neighbor grew GMO crops, and then the GMO seeds and pollen grow over into your crops, guess what happens? You can be sued by Monsanto for stealing their genetic material. That's true, unfortunately. That is actually true. And it is not just in the United States, by the way, but all over the world. For instance, in the UK, they would just the Bill Gates Foundation just granted an organization in the UK millions of dollars to promote the use of genetically modified food. So the Bill Gates Foundation is very linked to the extensive increase in GMO food in this country, as is the Obama administration, because unfortunately, so many of the regulatory agencies and the people that Obama put in charge, such as Tom Vilsack of Iowa, and Michael Taylor, who was a former Monsanto vice president and is now the FDA Deputy Commissioner of Food, Roger Bichi, who was the former director of the Monsanto-funded Danforth Plant Science Center, is now the director of the USDA, National Institute of Food and Agriculture. On and on, Elena Kagan, who as President Obama's Solicitor General, took Monsanto's side against organic farmers in the Roundup Ready alfalfa case, and now she's on the Supreme Court. So we know where President Obama and his administration stands on the Monsanto issue and on the GMO issue. We know where the Bill Gates Foundation stands on the GMO issue and the Monsanto issue. So really, if you're okay with it, do nothing. If you're not okay with it, I suggest that you do some reading, and you can easily vote online against these things. Go to organicconsumers.org. That's organicconsumers.org. They have a lot of links. Millions Against Monsanto is another good organization. Jeffrey Smith's organization on responsible technology. There's so many ways to find out more. And you can always go to naturalnurse.com. We have links for more information about all this on our website. Or you can go to Facebook, The Natural Nurse. That would be another way that you might want to find out what you can do to halt this proliferation. It's interesting that I was aware of the development of all this Monsanto-based products and the genetic modified products a very long time ago. Actually, it was way back in sort of the late 60s and 70s when they were first looking into formulating some of these genetically modified produce and other crops. Just looked diabolical, but never did I imagine in my wildest dreams that it would have proliferated to this extent, to where there's almost nothing you can pick up in the grocery store now that does not have some genetically modified molecules. And the health risks of this are to be seen. If you want to be part of the experiment, then just go ahead and eat that stuff. If you want to be part of the solution, then take a stand and tell your congressperson that you want genetically modified food labeled, just labeled. And then if you choose to eat it, go right ahead. But therefore, people who choose not to would at least actually have that choice. We're going to take a little break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And when we come back after hearing The Natural Medicine Chest, we will be bringing on board our guest for today. And she's going to be talking about a lot of interesting things. And her name is Dr. Heather Hasenblas. So we'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss an herb we all know and love, cinnamon.
Ah, the spicy, sweet smell of cinnamon. Everyone recognizes the familiar aroma of this common kitchen spice. But did you know that cinnamon is an exotic plant bark with a long history of medicinal use in many countries throughout the world? Cinnamon was listed as an herb with medicinal properties in Chinese literature as early as 2700 BC. It is described in the Chinese medical text, the Tang Materia Medica, written in 659 AD. Cinnamon also enjoys traditional use in Ayurvedic medicine, the ancient healing art of India. It is mentioned in the Book of Moses and has been cultivated in Ceylon and Sri Lanka since 1200 AD, where much of the world's supply is still grown.
In Europe, cinnamon was regarded as a rare and precious spice. Many pharmaceutical substances, such as cough syrups and digestive tonics, contain cinnamon. It was also used as an incense and in perfumes. According to Chamberlain, writing in France in 1887, cinnamon possesses the greatest antiseptic properties. Cinnamon is gathered from the dried inner bark of the branches of a small tropical evergreen laurel tree. The bark is peeled off, and as the pieces are dried, they curl up into quills. These are the common cinnamon sticks that are used in herb teas and for baking.
In Chinese medicine, cinnamon is one of the most widely used warming herbs to aid in circulation and digestion. It is a common ingredient in small amounts in tea used for nausea during pregnancy. It is also used following delivery to decrease hemorrhage. Cinnamon raises vitality, warms and stimulates all the vital functions of the body, counteracts congestion, improves the digestive system, relieves abdominal spasms, and aids in peripheral circulation. The essential oils contained in cinnamon include eugenol, cinnamic aldehyde, methyl eugenol, tannins, and mannitol, which give cinnamon its sweet flavor. It also contains cinzenolin and cinzenolol, which are both known insecticides.
Try putting some liquid soap and cinnamon in a spray bottle and use on plants as an organic bug repellent. Cinnamon is also included in many medicinal recipes that are used for lice, scabies, and other skin parasites. Cinnamon has antifungal, antiviral, and bactericidal activities. It has been shown to suppress E. coli, Staphylococcus, and Candida albicans.
So, listeners, the next time you inhale that sweet, spicy aroma, remember there's more to cinnamon than meets the nose as you reach into your natural medicine chest.
And welcome back to more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And I'm very happy to bring on board our guest, Dr. Heather Hasenblas. Dr. Hasenblas is a nationally and internationally renowned physical activity and healthy aging expert. I like that name, healthy aging instead of anti-aging, researcher and author. Her research focuses on the psychological effects of health behaviors across the lifespan. In particular, Dr. Hasenblas examines how physical activity and diet, including supplementation, relate to healthy aging. More specifically, her research focuses on the effects of physical activity and diet on body composition, body image, mood, adherence, eating behaviors, quality of life, and too much exercise. She's also applied theoretical models to examine the psychological effects of physical activity during pregnancy and postpartum and its relationship to the health of the entire family. Most recently, Dr. Hasenblas is examining the clinical effects of some new supplements, including resveratrol, saffron, and cacao. Thank you so much for being our guest today, Dr. Heather.
You know what? Thank you so much for having me.
You know, I'd like to know, with all the education that you've had, and a lot of it is what I would say in conventional science, what led you to this intense interest in healthy aging and healthy living?
You know, well, we're all aging, and for me, you know, once I became a mother, it became really important to me to live and try to live the healthiest life I could for my children. I want to be around for them, you know, when they graduate from high school, and to be a grandparent. So for me, that was really important, and that's what really kind of fostered and fueled my desire to really examine healthy aging.
And it looks like you have, both on a scientific level as well as a lifestyle level.
That's right.
Now, let's talk about some of these newer supplements that I know you've been writing a lot about and you actually have published studies on. And I was actually sent a heads up about research that you've done more recently on cacao. Is it cacao, the bean itself, or cocoa, or chocolate?
You know, that there's a bit of confusion, and it's called, you know, what can be called all. You know, the cacao is really the tree where we get the cocoa from, and, you know, we get the cocoa beans, which are really cocoa seeds, and that's where we get, you know, what we tend to know as the cocoa, which is the chocolate that we eat and that we love. And research is beginning to realize that, you know, there really are some very powerful health effects associated with cocoa and with chocolate, but you need to be eating the right, you know, the right type and know what you need to be eating to get all of these types of health effects.
Well, how would somebody know? Because there's such a variety of things on the market. And some of them, of course, claim to be healthy. There seems to be a lot of jumping on the bandwagon in terms of these new studies.
Right. And unfortunately, that happens oftentimes. But cocoa itself, you know, is loaded with compounds called flavanols, and that's what really gives it a lot of its health benefits. So in plants, flavanols provide important protection from free radicals. And I know a lot of people have heard about free radicals and how we want to kind of reduce this type of free radical damage in our bodies. But in particular with cocoa, it contains a certain type of flavanol called flavanols. And these cocoa flavanols prevent really fat-like substances in the bloodstream from clumping together and clogging the arteries. And it's leading to, you know, heart health effects. And what we're finding is that, you know, it's not going to be from the milk chocolate or the white chocolate. It's the dark chocolate where you're going to be getting and seeing these types of health effects more. And particularly, you want to look for, I want to tell people, if you really love chocolate, try to go for a dark chocolate, one that has at least 70%, you know, cocoa, because that's where you're going to get all that flavanol effect. Now, some people say, well, you know, I don't want to be eating, you know, a lot of chocolate, which I can understand because there's a lot of, you know, sugar and fat content and calories associated with it. So interestingly now, there are supplements that are out there that will contain, you know, the high cocoa flavanols without all the additional calories associated with eating the chocolate.
So you're getting just the good parts without the bad parts.
Yeah, you can look at it that way. Although, you know, we still, you know, I say we need to enjoy life too. And, you know, if you want to eat your dark chocolate, a little bit of it, and you also get these great health effects. But if you want another higher dose, I do recommend for people, you know, look for something that's pure, an organic cocoa supplement. I'm really big on organic because I think you're getting the best quality. And then you're going to get, get all these exciting and very healthy flavanols without the calories, the fat, and the sugar that are contained typically in chocolate bars or the confectionaries that we like to eat.
That's great advice. Now, since you've written so much about psychological effects and mood, isn't there some discussion about chocolate releasing endorphins and other feel-good hormones?
You know what, there is, and there's a lot of, you know, a lot of anecdotal stuff that is out there, and there's some research too saying that, you know, when we eat chocolate, you know, it may put us in a better mood. We may, you know, feel better. And it's probably coming from, you know, that neurotransmitter level where it's actually releasing, you know, those neurotransmitters, like, you know, getting the serotonin out there to kind of improve our mood. A lot of it is anecdotal, but there is some science beginning to emerge showing that, you know what, There is a reason why we tend to really, you know, not only enjoy the taste of the chocolate, but it also makes us feel better as well. And we tend to want to do things that make us feel better. And interestingly, also with cocoa, there's been, you know, an interesting clinical trial that came out showing that it also has skin health effects as well, which is really exciting as we're talking about healthy aging. So not only does it seem to be affecting us, you know, at the cellular level on the inside, but it's going to be reflected on, you know, how we look with our skin. So that's very exciting as well.
Sometimes I think I'm kind of lucky in that I actually don't like chocolate. So many people, I remember also women, when they're having PMS or even as they reach more of a menopausal time, really crave chocolate. And then they seem to overdo it. And we're not talking about just the isolated actives that you see are very beneficial, but perhaps it's that sugar and fat content that draws them to it. And then they overeat it and then have a crash, all kinds of things like that.
That's right. I mean, it's something that, you know, we do crave. I mean, I love chocolate, and unfortunately, from a health standpoint, I really like the milk chocolate, and I'm slowly trying to eat more, you know, if I have a choice, to try to choose dark chocolate. You know, because I know of the health benefits associated with cocoa, you know, I will also, you know, take an organic cocoa supplement so that I am getting, you know, the flavanols in my diet.
That's a good way to do it, to bring it in a balanced way. I'd like to talk more about your research on exercise, because I think if exercise could be bottled, it probably would be absolutely the best in terms of any drug or any supplement that's available.
You know what? I agree 100%. And if, you know, I tell people there is one thing that you can do for your health, and there's many things that we can do if we take a look, you know, from a preventative medicine type of standpoint, whether it's, you know, getting a mammogram or some type of, you know, screening for like high blood pressure, and all these types of things are really important. But I think if we could pick just one thing, you know, if you had only one thing that you could do to try to stay healthy and do healthy aging, it would be physical activity. It really touches on every system in our body. So we know that people that are regularly physically active are going to be, you know, from a physiological standpoint, more healthy, but also psychologically and socially as well. So it's so exciting that it touches upon all of these types of, you know, all of these types of systems. And I tell people, you know, it's self-sustaining. So, you know, you don't need to, it doesn't cost a lot of money to do. There's really no negative types of side effects. So once you get started, you can keep going with it.
Now, that's the whole thing. How do people get motivated, and is there one kind of exercise over another that you would advocate?
You know, I think the simplest thing that comes back is walking. And the motivation aspect is a challenge because, you know, we're in the minority, the people that regularly exercise. And what I tend to study is why do people not exercise? Most people, if you ask them, if you're standing in a corner and people are walking by and you're to ask them, is exercising good for you? 99% of people are going to say, yes, it is. But only about, you know, 25% of these people are going to be regularly physically active. So the question comes into play is, why do most people know it's so good for them, yet so few people do? And it comes down to the psychology and the motivation and trying to get people motivated to do, you know, regular physical activity. And what I recommend to people is, you know what, just put on a pair of shoes and go for a walk, a brisk walk. You want to get your heart rate up a little bit. But a lot of people have this feeling that they need to go to the gym, that it needs to be, you know, vigorous and strenuous and something that they don't enjoy. And I say to them, you know what, make it something that you do like. If you like to, you know, hang out with a friend, make it this time where you go out for, you know, a 10, a 15-minute walk with them, or walk your dog, or take your kids out, so that you're kind of coupling, you know, two or three things at once, because a lot of people will say, you know what, I just don't have the time to be physically active. So I try to help them find ways during the day when they can be physically active. And it's a huge challenge, because I think one of the most complex things to try to understand is human behavior, and to try to change people to, you know, behavior and what they do.
Well, like you said, it's not a matter of changing people, it's a matter of people making a different choice.
Right.
Exactly. And that. And I want to tell our listeners, Dr. Hasenblass, that you are not just coming at this off the cuff. you are actually an extremely well-published author, and I'm looking just at a little list of your books. Psychological Physical Activity. I imagine that's the psychology of physical activity. Group Dynamics in Sports. Psychology of Physical Activity. Again, Handbook on Sports Psychology. Group Dynamics in Sports. So this is something you have studied really in depth.
Yes, I've been, since graduate school, this is what I have studied and have been so intrigued by, because I really wanted to understand, you know, what are the psychological effects and benefits of being physically active, and why do most people not exercise regularly when they do know that it is so good for them? So that has been something that's been really a passion of mine, to understand, you know, what are the barriers or the excuses that people will give for why they're not active, and how can we get them to overcome, you know, these barriers so that they will be regularly physically active.
And what I do also with my patients, well, myself, you know, I have no trouble, because I think there's also an endorphin release linked to exercise. And I know since I do exercise every single day, if I don't, I really feel like I'm missing something. And it's interesting, because I'm looking at a chapter that you're involved in writing called Exercise Dependence, Eating Disorder, and Body Dysmorphia. What does that mean?
Well, I also, like, I take a look at the full spectrum, because most people are not physically active or regularly physically active. They just don't exercise enough. But I also take a look at the other extreme of people who actually exercise too much. And there are those people out there, and we can call them, you know, exercise dependents or exercise, you know, addicted individuals. And I think that we need to understand the full spectrum so that, you know, understanding why somebody may exercise too much can help us to try to get people who are not exercising to start to exercise. So there's a big relationship between, you know, exercise, you know, diet, and body image. And we do know that people who exercise report that they feel better about their body, and they're just more body satisfied. And that is such an important characteristic, because individuals who are body dissatisfied tends to lead to a lot of dieting, oftentimes yo-yo dieting, and it's the number one precursor for, you know, eating disordered behaviors and eating disorders. So if we can kind of stop at that body dissatisfaction by having people have a healthy body image, then it will not lead to that eating disorder. So it's that kind of prevention type of approach that I like to look at.
Well, one thing I always share with my patients as well, like you were saying, make it easy. And you don't have to have money for a gym. You don't have to have 3 hours a day. One thing I tell people to try is to get a little mini trampoline and keep it in the living room in front of the television. And then even start out just walking on it. And if it gets up to it, eventually just very gently bouncing on it. Just during every commercial in a one-hour show. And somehow they find that very non-threatening, and they're able to take that as their first exercise step.
I like that approach, you know, trying to make it simple and easy for people. A lot of people get very intimidated to go to a gym, and that'll actually make them, you know, nervous and anxious. And if you're nervous and anxious, then you're not going to enjoy exercising. So you want to try to, you know, get things that people will enjoy. And I tell people, you know, you don't need to go and for this vigorous, long, you know, run or go to the gym for an hour. If you can fit in 30 minutes a day, let's say you do a 10-minute walk in the morning, bring your, you know, walking shoes to work and go for a 10-minute walk at lunch and then maybe a 10-minute walk in the evening, then you've got what you've needed, you know, from a health standpoint, of accumulating these 30 minutes during the day. I tell people, do what you enjoy. If you like being outside, then go for a walk outside. If you like to do things indoors, there's so many, you know, exercise DVDs or things that you can do around the house. I kind of joke with my husband and tell him that, you know, vacuuming is physical activity. hoping that he'll start to vacuum, but that hasn't rubbed off. But there are things that, you know, that you can do. One of the things that I do is I typically, when I'm home with the kids, is that I will dress in, you know, workout attire so that at any moment I am able to get up and go outside with them or run or play catch. And it just makes it very easy for me because I'm already dressed that way, so that I'm able to start to do anything physically active with them right away.
Well, that is definitely, definitely good advice. And we're just going to go for a little break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z so we can hear about more of the exciting shows that we have available for you right here on PRN, Progressive Radio Network, the Gary Null Network. And you can be visiting us anytime on the archives or any time of day to listen to all the wonderful information we have available for you. We'll be right back with more on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Joining me, this is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse, and you can find us at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse. And we love it when you go to Facebook, The Natural Nurse, and like us, and then you get information about all our up-and-coming classes and workshops. We have so many all over the country, and we have one in Chinatown, New York, on October 21st, where you can actually join with myself and Dr. Eugene Zamperone and have a walk in Chinatown and learn all about the history of Chinese medicine, as well as very specific techniques such as tongue and pulse diagnosis. And it's a wonderful day. It'll be our 25th year of leading a Chinatown herb walk, so you can join us for that. For those of you who would like to get credit in holistic medicine, we are sponsoring a evidence-based natural therapy symposium, and that is going to be October 6th, 2012, at the University of Bridgeport. If you go to naturalnurse.com and click on schedules, you can get a full flyer about that, and it will yield 5 CEU credits, professional credits, to anyone who would like them. You can come and take the full day class if you want to and not get credits, but for those of you who are healthcare professionals interested in holistic medicine, there are 5 credits available. So that's just some of the exciting workshops and classes that we have coming up through The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. You can just visit us at naturalnurse.com. And, of course, we're so happy to be part of Gary Null's network, the Progressive Radio Network. One of the exciting things is you can tune in anytime, day or night, to get information that you want and you need. And today we have, as our radio guest, Dr. Heather Hasenblas. And for those of you who have been listening, you know that Dr. Hasenblas is extremely knowledgeable. She obtained her doctorate from the University of Western Ontario in Canada. And since 1998, she has been a faculty member at the University of Florida. And she is nationally and internationally renowned as a physical activity and healthy aging expert, researcher, and author. So thank you so much for joining us back on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
Thank you.
And great information about exercise and psychology, and we talked a little bit about cocoa. Let's talk about some of the other new supplements that are appearing on the shelf, such as resveratrol. That's a good one because there's been lots of new research about resveratrol.
It really has been in the last couple of years, and I think most people are now becoming familiar with the word resveratrol as an antioxidant. It really has gotten a lot of media coverage, and I think it, because of the connection with the French paradox and why do the French seem to suffer less, you know, heart disease than other countries despite, you know, their eating of, you know, lots of cheese and, you know, the red wine that they drink and, you know, the pastries. And for many years, people have been hypothesizing that it has something to do with the red wine that they drink. And over time, researchers have found out that there's a very special molecule that is found in really fairly high quantity doses as far as a food source in red wine, and it's called resveratrol. And since this time, researchers began to really examine some of the health effects of resveratrol, in particular taking a look at some clinical trials, which have found, you know, some heart health effects of resveratrol. So people right away will say, well, this is great. I can drink lots of red wine. Well, I tell people you probably need to drink thousands of glasses a day to get the health effects that you would see or the doses that are used in these clinical studies. So what I recommend for people is, you know what, there are great supplements out there that contain, you know, resveratrol without the negative effects of drinking the red wine and all the calories and so forth that are associated with it. But I think of one, you know, clinical trial in particular that just came out in 2012. And what makes this clinical trial so exciting for resveratrol is that it's the longest clinical trial that's ever been done. It was a one-year study. And what this study did is they actually recruited people who were at high risk for cardiovascular disease. So these individuals had diabetes, high cholesterol, and one other cardiovascular risk factor, and then they were randomized into different conditions. And what they found was that the individuals who were in the resveratrol condition over the course of the year saw multiple improvements in kind of risk factors associated with cardiovascular disease. So it was a very exciting study that was showing, you know what, resveratrol over the long term with these individuals who are at high risk are showing, you know, these significant improvements and, you know, markers of inflammation, and they were having increases in, you know, very positive hormones in the body. So this is really, really exciting for resveratrol that we're seeing these health effects, in particular these heart health effects.
Yes, now that is exciting. And, you know, if people are just relying on wine, one thing that can be a problem is that if it is not organic, that it also has sulfites. So, you know, there's a trade-off there. Well, if you're using an active constituent of resveratrol, first of all, you know how much you're getting. And second of all, it can be in a more purified form. What are some of the physiological parameters that have been shown to be positively impacted by using resveratrol?
Well, you know what, it's coming out as really one of those superpowered, you know, antioxidants, and not in humans yet, but having some, you know, cancer, you know, chemopreventative activities. So it's very exciting, and the belief is that it's really difficult to kind of pinpoint the mechanisms, but the belief is that it's actually, you know, working at the cellular level to really increase or improve the health and the vitality of the cell, if you want to think of it that way. And actually, it may be activating certain types of genes called these sirtuin genes, which are known to be associated with longevity. So if these genes are kind of activated, then it leads to a whole host of health benefits. So we're seeing now that resveratrol has this really unique unique effect, and it's a polyphenol. And people are really interested in where exactly does it come from. If you think of the grape, resveratrol actually grows naturally on the grape to kind of protect the grape, you know, from different types of harsh climates, UV, radiation, for example. So it seems to be that it's having potentially similar types of effects within the human body, which makes it very, you know, very exciting. And I'm a big proponent of, you know, natural, and I really think that it's important. And you've mentioned the organic. So if somebody wants to, you know, drink red wine, I always recommend try to get an organic, you know, red wine. You know, and different wines have different levels of resveratrol, although they're very low. Like a Merlot will have less resveratrol typically than a Pinot Noir. It's just basically how the grape grows. So what I recommend for individuals, if you're interested in resveratrol as part of your healthy aging process, to look for a resveratrol supplement that is organic and that contains that whole grape kind of polyphenol complex, as well as Japanese knotweed, which is a medicinal plant that contains the highest levels of trans-resveratrol. And I always recommend for people to look for trans-resveratrol because this is the active component of the resveratrol, and that's the component that is most studied and will give you the health effects. As well, I recommend for people to look for quercetin as well within their supplement, because this polyphenol, it's also a polyphenol, and it works kind of synergistically with resveratrol to kind of increase the absorption within the body, which is so important when we're taking supplements. You want to make sure that it's doing what you want it to do within your body. So I think this makes for a nice combination for a powerful resveratrol anti-aging supplement if people are looking for that.
Now, I know that sometimes the animal studies were interesting because I know that there was one mouse study that was actually done at Harvard, and it got an awful lot of press, showing weight loss components to resveratrol. And whenever people feel that, I think it gives them a little bit of an unrealistic expectation, like you can do nothing else, not all the other great things that you talked about here on the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z today, such as exercise and paying attention to what you're eating, but just take a little resveratrol and suddenly you're going to lose weight. But that's what the research seemed to point to in terms of the rat study.
And you know what? It's interesting. And the study that you're alluding to was done by a Harvard medical scientist by the names of Bauer and Sinclair. And this study, a very well-designed study, and it got a lot of media attention. And unfortunately, sometimes the media would run with it as this, you know, great new weight loss supplement. And that's not necessarily the case. There is one clinical trial that has come out showing, you know, weight loss, you know, management types of effects that we are seeing. But by no means do I ever want people to think that all they need to do is take a resveratrol supplement and they're going to lose any supplement and lose a significant amount of weight. That's not the case. I mean, I think that it can help, but people need to also, watch what they're eating, eat more healthy and move more. And when you kind of couple that all within your routine, I think then you're going to begin to see, you know, the best types of effects.
Right. That makes perfect sense. Now, one other supplement that's been sort of becoming more popular is an ancient herb or spice that is used mostly in Indian cooking called saffron. What can you tell us about that?
You know, it's one that's receiving a bit of attention, a lot of clinical research recently. And for those people that cook, they've heard of saffron. It's really the world's most expensive spice by weight. And it's been used for thousands of years, you know, to provide color, aroma, and flavor to food. And it really has a very long history as part of traditional medicine for treating a lot of illnesses. And most recently, a clinical trial found that by taking a saffron supplement led to people's decreases in their desire and their need to snack. And we know that it's a challenge for a lot of people when they're trying to either maintain or maybe lose weight or eat more healthy. A lot of people will engage in snacking. And typically when people snack, unfortunately, it tends to be the unhealthier types of foods because they're hungry and they go for, you know, the high calorie dense types of foods. And in this clinical trial, they found that when these women took the saffron supplementation, they had a significant reduction in their desire and their need to snack. So not surprising, they weren't snacking as much, and then they were also losing weight. And they did not change their diet or their physical activity. So you can probably attribute this effect to the saffron. So what I recommend for people, if you're trying to either maintain, lose weight, or maybe eat a little more healthy, and one of your issues is that you snack a lot or you crave a lot of foods, then the saffron supplementation might be a great way for you to kind of start to, you know, maintain or control your weight, coupled, you know, obviously with improving or eating more healthy and engaging in physical activity.
You know, I'm really a little puzzled about how some of the manufacturers can offer saffron supplements at such a low price when we know that the spice itself is incredibly expensive.
Right, and that's a great question. And it comes down to how it's actually cultivated and being able to put it within the supplement form. And that's a good question that people will often ask. And, you know, because saffron is a flower, it's actually a very pretty looking flower, and it has a very complex chemistry, and it's actually picked by hand. So that's what leads to it being very, very expensive. And I don't know much about the science of the cultivation, but I know that in the saffron supplements, however they're able to cultivate it, it becomes much less expensive within supplement form.
Yeah, it's just strange. I just wonder where they're getting it, you know, and what kind of quality it is. But anyway, there's always a lot of unanswered questions about that. But you're saying, what about just using it as a spice instead of taking it as a supplement? Is it like highly standardized where a supplement would be more useful?
Well, you know, saffron itself is, you know, regarded as safe. So it's safe. And if you were to use it as a spice, which is great, but you would need to use a lot, really too much than what you'd want within a plate of food to get the dose that we see in these clinical trials. So using it in your food is a great way. But what I recommend also, if you want to actually get that higher dose that we see in these clinical studies, to actually take a saffron supplementation that is available if you want to get that additional saffron health effect.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today, Dr. Heather Hasenblas. And I do have a link to your website on the right here at The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z if people would like to visit this show on the archive. But is there any other way that people can find you, or is there any other place that you might want to share with our listeners?
You know, I'm just most recently created a face page. I'm a little behind, I think, on all this social media. And the website is a great way. Or people can also contact me via email. I check my email constantly if they have ever any questions or comments, and I'll respond fairly quickly back to them.
So what is your Facebook page?
It is just it's just my name, Heather Hasenblas.
Okay, not the easiest thing to spell, but in case you do want to know more, listeners, going to our page at the archives right here on Progressive Radio Network, which you can always find at prn.fm, then go to archives, go to Natural Nurse, and Dr. Heather's show will be there. And by the way, Dr. Heather, you can also download that show for your website as well.
Oh, thank you.
Have it for the future. And thank you so much for joining us today. And you really discussed a lot of simple and easy and quite delicious tips when we're talking about wine and chocolate and the spiced saffron as being useful condiments, and then interspersing that with healthy exercise. And you're just well on your way to being a healthy and happy individual, which is what we love you to be. And this is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse, for myself and the station Progressive Radio Network. We're hoping that you stay healthy.